So the title of the talk is If There's No Self, So Whose Back Is Hurting? We all go through difficult experiences, physically, mentally, spiritually. It's the name of the game. When we actually sit and stop and allow things to surface into the consciousness by not running away from them and by not busy suppressing them and getting rid of them, but we sit here kind of in a pressure cooker of a retreat, things do come up. And this is natural. Our biography comes up. Our body pains come up. All the conditionings, the wounds, the scars, and the just the accumulated pains of existence will tend to arise like stuff floating up to the surface of the pond. A quiet pond, stuff will come up. So I can understand if many of you were saying, look, just leave me alone with this talk of perfection, this talk of non-self, this talk of ultimacy. Just, my back is hurting, my mind is hurting, I've got stories going around, I can't stop. I feel... I just want to run back to Tel Aviv. So leave me alone. And certainly Stephen, that's sitting up on the stage, is all very well for him to talk. Probably his back doesn't hurt. So he can talk about ultimate things. So... we need to look again at the difficulty, also the difficulty from the point of view of self and me. Because the problem with the difficulty of life is that actually we don't really hold it with wisdom and clarity. We don't hold that stuff with clarity. We tend to simply act it in life. So we have we have a group of tendencies. We feel restlessness, agitation, isheket, just like you heard this morning in the instructions from Lila. It's one of the hindrances, the michsholim. Usually we don't even know we have it. It's just making us get up and go. It's just making us turn on the TV. It's just making us have another cup of coffee. It's just making us not being able to sit quietly in a chair like my cat for 2 hours. And so it's the reactivity, the automatic way in which difficult experiences are just manifest in us. We don't know they're in the biography. We don't know that they're written into the body until we sit and stop. And then what's written in the body appears. And we say, oh, my back is hurting. Oh, my knees are hurting. Oh, my body is hurting. Oh, my mind is hurting. I'm bored. I'm tired. I'm fed up. We don't realize that all we're doing is giving space to what's there before. And so we need to look again at what I was saying before. Our freedom is inside the moment of experience and not in another place. So what's the freedom inside the moment of experience of a back that hurts? Well, how's that actually going to free me up if I understand the teaching that in the moment of the back hurting, there is freedom. How am I to understand that? It seems a kind of impossible. So I want to work a little bit on the teaching that is the key teaching of the three characteristics, which in the Tibetan tradition is called the three seals. Seals, Khotamim? Khotamim. Or the three marks. And three marks, or three characteristics, or three seals, are a way of understanding what is an experience from the point of view of Dharma. So when we just experience something and we react to something we hear in an automatic way, there essentially is no Dharma there. We are just functioning on automatic, and our whole life we can keep functioning on automatic. We can have happy moments, unhappy moments, but there's something that is not Dharma. That means the not the truth of the way things really are. They are a automatic behaviors, thoughts, words, and experiences that are not really seen as an experience. So the three marks, or the three characteristics, are the core teaching, which you can summarize as right view. You can summarize it as Dharma, namely the truth of the way things are, more deeply, or you can summarize as right view. Right view is a way of looking more deeply, more clearly, more honestly, under the surface, at what's really happening, and it is the summary of the Eightfold Path. And here I'm talking about lists and so on and so on, but just you can put it in brackets if you want, the Sograin, but I'm just giving it to you anyway. The Eightfold Path is the fourth of the Four Noble Truths. Awakening is depending on us experiencing freedom more and more and more, undoing clinging, attachment, holding on, and the Eightfold Path is the Buddhist way, which includes meditation, right speech, right action, and so on, all leading to view, a view of reality. And this view of reality you can summarize as the three characteristics. I want to talk about them a bit. And the first is dukkha. Dukkha means dissatisfaction, suffering, difficulty, pain. And it's basically, fundamentally, it's our desire for things to be different from what they are. It's the pressure that we feel all our life for things that we don't want to stop or go away, such as a disease, such as a pain, such as a bad relationship, such as a terrible partner, such as the fighting, disputes, wars, inside us, outside us, anything that we don't want to be there. Or something that we do want to be there, that's not there. Like desires that we want more and more and more. The next $1 million and the next $1 million and the next $1 million. Pain is a very obvious example of dukkha. We want simply to stop it. We want it to go away. We want to deal with it. We want to rush to the Patrolim in Afula now because my back is hurting and I'm on a retreat and I just want a pill to stop it. The obvious dukkha are these pains and difficulties that we've experienced as pain, as a disease, as loss, They're less obvious dukkha, which we also experience, the dukkha of change. We actually want to keep things as they are. We want things to stay as they are. We actually don't like change. We're creatures that we have our track. We have our what we're used to. We don't like things that we're not used to. We're afraid of the unknown. We're afraid of the unexpected. We want to know what's going on. The most kind of common reaction to life is maye. What will happen next? What do I have to be careful of? What do I have to watch for? What do I have to protect myself against? In case this happens. In case that will happen. That's most of our life is busy with that, which is protecting ourselves against something that hasn't actually happened. But we don't want change. We don't want unknown. We don't want unexpected. So that's another type of dukkha. And the third dukkha, which is more subtle than that, is the dukkha of conditioning. We're actually open, sensitive, aware beings. And what comes in seems to be like all the time we get hit with a patish chamesh kilo. This sensitive human being is all the time getting conditioned by others, by life. And all the scars and the wounds and the the whole force or pressure of society, of parents, of school, of what we learn or what we hear or what we know, what we don't know, the whole conditioning shapes us. And then we arrive in this moment with a certain shape. And we are shaped by life. And it's painful. It's like we are put inside I won't tell the story again because I've told it so many times and I'm afraid of boring everybody with my stories. But it's just like someone that's putting on a suit, khalifa, that simply doesn't fit them anymore. And so they're walking around like this inside a suit, the toch khalifa, that's completely twisted. And then they have to walk through life kind of limping and wearing a nice suit. And we really, that's the pain of dukkha, of conditioning. And we want to take it off, this suit, this khalifa, and throw it away, and dance, and be free. But we have conditioning, we have a shape. A long time ago, I was at a party in Tel Aviv. It was a kind of street party, and music and drums, and it was really nice. And I had a bunch of grandchildren there as well. And all of a sudden, there was a telephone call, and I couldn't hear properly, but I heard someone was sobbing and crying on the other side of the telephone. And I thought, well, I have to relate to this. And I couldn't hear; I just heard crying, and I just understood that someone was crying because they went to an old party of their kita from school and they realized how much 10 years of schooling has screwed them up, this person. And she was crying because she said, I've realized 10 years of school, or 12 or whatever years, has made me twisted. And I couldn't have a one-to-one in these circumstances with the music around and so on the telephone. I said, look, and it suddenly, I said, look, I live in a place in Clil with thousands of olive trees. Every olive tree is totally different. Every olive tree has a shape. This olive tree is like this. This olive tree is like that. This olive tree is like that. Why? Because the wind shaped this tree, and the water shaped this tree, and the DNA shaped this one, and the food that they in the earth, this one, and the disease shaped this one. So we're all shaped by life. We can feel that as pain, dukkha of conditioning, just like this woman did. And I told her this story, I told her just what came up, told her, it's okay to be with your shape. The shape is the way conditioning created us at this minute. We need to be okay with it. Just be okay. This is our shape at this moment. So, but it's painful. You can understand how we can feel the pain of it. So if we look more carefully at dukkha, and as dukkha is one of the characteristics or one of the dharma, the way things are, we understand that dukkha is just dukkha. We don't need to do anything with it. We don't need to try and fix everything. We don't need to go against it. We don't need to turn it into anything or build anything out of it. Dukkha is a part, is a natural part of our life. And we just see it as dukkha. This is suffering, or this is dissatisfaction. So we have a craving for something, we have desire, strong desire, we have an aversion for something, unpleasant experience. Unpleasantness is part of our human experience. We just allow unpleasantness. We don't need to do anything with it, we don't need to add to it, we don't need to make story out of it, we don't need to build a self out of it. If we just see that in experience is dissatisfaction, we can actually be free without the tendency all our life to try and fix things. We can be free and allow an unpleasant experience to arise and go. And just say, just knowing this is an unpleasant experience. This is painful. This is pleasant. This is unpleasant. That's it. And we find ourselves inside bigger than dukkha. Because we can contain dukkha in our awareness. So we actually are not dukkha anymore. We are bigger than the dukkha. We are bigger than dissatisfaction. Because we just see it arising and passing. What sees it arising and passing? The sense of awareness, knowing. And therefore the knowing isn't hurting. The hurt is seen by the knowing. So the knowing doesn't hurt. The knowing is just knowing. So if we live with knowing, we live without the hurt. The hurt will appear and disappear. But the knowing is still free. So you probably heard the story of the second arrow, traditional story, that what we tend to do is to be like somebody that is hurt by an arrow. A chetz is hurting him, then the chetz drops down, and he carries on taking taking this arrow, the chetz, and carrying on. So we have a pain in the body, and we say, why have I got the pain in the body? I shouldn't have a pain in the body. I'm sitting here quietly. Why is it happening to me? I'm just a victim. It's always happening to me. I don't expect it. I should have a blissful retreat. And they promised me in Tovana that this will be a total bliss and liberation. And here I am, stuck in, like, slipping along without all my body hurting, and it's not fair. That's the second, third, fourth arrow. And we tend to build our life from the second, third, fourth arrow. All it is unpleasant experiences moving through the system, because that's in the nature of life. And it's our business to actually recognize dukkha. And it's often not so easy, because we're so used to it that we can have an experience that's quite subtle. I've got a problem that I feel every time I'm in this situation, I feel discomfort. And those people are annoying me. Okay, those people are annoying me. The minute we turn around the view and see it as dukkha, it's not the people anymore. It's dukkha. So we have taken responsibility for an unpleasant experience that arises in us. We no longer need to blame the people. It's taking responsibility ourselves, turning, the Buddha called it the great turning, to turn the gaze, to turn, to take responsibility of our own mind and heart. This is a big thing. The Buddha said, people who do this are like roaring like lions. The power of being able to take responsibility for our own mind is a huge power. In order to do this, we need to see. Dukkha is arising. Unpleasantness is arising. There are people there that are causing it in me. I'm not going to blame the people or it's not the people that I have to think about. It's the arising of dukkha. Then, when I understand the arising of dukkha, I can turn to those people and hopefully with more wisdom and freedom tell them to shut up. So the voices of isipuk, dissatisfaction, can be quite subtle. They're the voices of imperfection, ishlemut. The imperfections. It's not enough. I want it better. It can go into our spiritual life. We want experiences which we don't get. We want things to be changed. We want to be liberated quicker. We want it now. We want the right experiences that we ought to be having as a Buddhist meditator. We should be having certain experiences, we're not having them. Why? Dukkha, dukkha. In a very subtle way, just moving our body. I mean, several of us are moving our body right in this room. If each one of us that is moving our body asks deeply, why do I need to move my body now, at this minute? We will very subtly find a small voice of dukkha saying, you'd be more comfortable if you move your head. You'd be more comfortable if you move your hand. You'd be more comfortable if you move your eyes. You'd be more comfortable if you shift your body. It's not a problem. But it is dukkha. We have to recognize, even on a subtle level, when we move our body, it's because something needs to be changed. In a very subtle level, we need to fix something. So dukkha is that voice. And it's important to see it as being a partner and a teacher. If we see dukkha as a teacher, as one of our a real teacher of ours, it's no longer a problem. It's an invitation. It's an invitation to meet our limit. It's an invitation to see how far we can go. To go further, to go deeper, to go beyond our usual boundary of comfort. It's breaking the comfort zone. Instead of all the time fixing it. So dukkha is for us a teacher. And when people in the spiritual life come with stories of dukkha, very often the thing to do is to actually turn the view and say dukkha is inviting us to look deep, to look deeper, to look at what really what's happening, because it's a voice that's telling us something. It's for us. And very, very simply, what's pain? Pain is a voice in the body that's saying, please pay attention to me. That's all it is. It's a biological, physiological mechanism that says, I'm here, something's wrong, please pay attention. Like a crying baby that says, here I am, something's wrong, I need attention. That's all it is. So all dukkha is inviting us to pay attention. It's not inviting us to start feeling a victim. It's inviting us simply to pay attention to dukkha. We may go to the doctor, that's fine. The Buddha had a doctor. We don't need to think, oh, well, all I have to do is know dukkha, and then I don't need to take any medicine. I can die quite happily in a Tovana retreat. No, of course we take medicine. Of course we go to eat. Of course we look after ourselves as we need to. That's fine. No problem whatsoever. If you've had enough back pain, nobody's telling you mustn't change your position, or you mustn't take an Akamol. Don't know. But the voices are the voice of truth. And when we are close to the voice of truth, we live in a bigger, freer world. So dukkha is one of those voices. Dukkha is Dharma. The second of the three marks is anicca. And anicca is the fact, is, what is it, toblanu? It's so good for us that if we look carefully, nothing stays. Nothing is stuck. And it's such a liberating understanding. Nothing stays. We may build a illusion that this thing that I don't like is here forever. We may build an illusion, I've got a pattern or a habit of thought that gives me suffering. And obviously, you know, we can think of examples, trauma that's stuck in the system. It feels like a very solid and permanent thing. And indeed, if it's too strong, very difficult to deal with in the way I'm talking about. And sometimes things are difficult to deal with, and we need help, and we need a psychologist, or we need a professional help. And not saying that everything is solvable through a meditation course. But if we look carefully at something which is, in, shall we say, possible to do, and that's for us as normal, healthy, suffering human beings, we will see that it's made of constantly changing groups of experiences. It's not one thing, this thing that I'm suffering from. It's not a thing. It's a dynamic. It's something that's flowing, it's something that's free, it's something that passes. All the scars that we experience in our life that seem to be there so solid, if we look carefully at them, they're actually full of life. The pain in the body seems very solid, it's a thing, it's a gush, it's annoying, it's there, it keeps being there, it seems to be solid, it seems to be stuck. But if we look carefully from the ki'ilu, from the inside, we go inside the pain, we look at what it is saying to us, its voice, we will see that it's constantly changing Now it's hot, now it's cool, now it stops, now it starts. Same with the mind. We had a couple of retreats a few years ago on the Holocaust, which I was teaching a retreat in Germany, in Berlin, and in Israel. And there were Germans and Israelis. And both Germans and Israelis came to the retreat with a sense of stuckness. That this thing, the Holocaust, is so big and so deep in the culture, in the memory, in the conditioning, in the psychological world, in the patterns of thinking, in the fears that we have in our life, and in the way it steals joy, both from the Israelis and the Germans. So it seems to be a thing that's so dominant, and we can feel it in our whole culture, in the Jewish culture, as something that is a narrative, a story, that is seems to be so internalized that it's taken as an absolute truth and held inside as a thing. But what we were doing over a few days working together is melting it, is seeing as it really is, coming and going as an experience. Yes, there were some tears, and yes, there was laughter. How can there be laughter with the Shoah as a narrative? But yes, of course we can laugh and be happy and joyful. And if it steals our joy, then we've made it into a monster. So we were talking about the Shoah, the Holocaust, as like the elephant in the room. As long as it's an elephant in the room that nobody looks at, that is just there, we're all dancing around, and the elephant's taking all the space, and we're kind of squeezed in a corner. But as soon as we see it as it is, we see the room, and we see the elephant. It's got a tail, it's got big ears, it's not so bad, it happened, there was suffering, but there's also joy, there's also friendship, there's also Germans and Israelis in this Holocaust retreat. We're hugging, and we're in the transformation that happened. A lot of release and freedom was experienced when we don't feel that this elephant that's in the room is sort of taking all the space. So everything we look at, especially when we zoom in a resolution that's higher resolution, in the microscope of our attention. And here's where we need samadhi, where samadhi is helpful to us. When we zoom in, we see how everything has a short shelf life. Chaye madaf, ma'od mod katsar. It has a short shelf life, it passes. Nothing is that solid. And so, if nothing is solid, then trying to fix things is also a bit like trying to fix clouds. You can't fix clouds. And then we realize we don't really need to fix so much because it's going by itself. If everything passes by, what do we need to fix? There's nothing that needs to be fixed because it's gone before we try and fix it. So that, it's a liberating understanding. The understanding of anicca. Dynamic. Everything is dynamic. Everything goes by itself. We don't need to get rid of things that disturb us. We just need to see that it is passing by itself. It may come back, but if we know clearly that it's passing by itself, it goes by itself, then that knowledge reduces the intensity with which it comes back. In our practice, I really, really recommend to keep noticing the ending of things. The ending of a thought. Right? Just keep noticing the ending of other things, the vanishing of things, the way things just pop, gone. Gone, gone, gone. anicca. And the third of the marks is anatta. Anatta is the theme of this retreat. So I want to say that what we're doing in this retreat is just picking out anatta as a main theme in this particular retreat, but it could have been any of the others. And I don't think we can really market a retreat called a dukkha retreat. I don't think there'll be 100 people in a dukkha retreat. Maybe there'll be 50 people in an anicca retreat, but a guaranteed 100 people in an anatta retreat. Anatta, because it has a word, so it turns into a concept. Anatta means not atta. An is not, and atta is self. So it means non-self, but not no self. It means non-self, eder ani. And the best description of anatta that I can think of comes from Winnie the Pooh, who once said, the more Pooh looked, the more Piglet wasn't there. The more Pooh looked, the more Piglet wasn't there. It's transparent, the self. It's not that there is no self-experience. Because, of course, we have the experience that it's my back that's hurting. We don't want to deny experience, but we want to go deeper and look at the core, the mahut, the essence, the dharma inside an experience. And the dharma inside the experience, the dharma of anatta, simply says, just try and find this self that seems to be there all the time. It seems to say, my back is hurting. But if you look carefully, and the careful look reveals dharma rather than illusion, if we look carefully, we will not find the ownership of back when we say my back is hurting. We will not be able to find the owner of the back. It's just like that. I know, you know, take that home with you and try. Try it here. Look for the owner of the back. It's crazy. But it's dharma. This is the truth of the way things are. Who owns your back? You don't own your back. God made your back. I don't know. Your back is made of millions of cells. Your back is made of carbon and hydrogen and oxygen and air. Your back is made of experiences. Your back is made of DNA. Your back is made of what other people think of you. Your back is made of what you think about it. Your million things make a back, and then we make a sort of summary of it and say, my back. My back hurts. So it's, my is a response, is not a thing. Me is a response and not a thing. Tguva v'lo davar. And we simply can't find it. If we look for a thing, we will not be able to find it. It is just like the story of the emperor's new clothes. There's one boy who is real little baby Buddha that stands up and says, but the emperor is naked. Everyone seems to see the emperor has clothes called my, me. But the emperor is naked. So we need to be innocent like a boy, like a child that looks at the emperor's new clothes We need to have that innocent gaze. This, because their first look, clarity to see, actually, ownership, ba'alut, is illusion. It's just a habit. It doesn't really exist. Well, one very good example of this is the self that's built by others. We had a discussion about this in the group today. The social identity. And a girl was asking in the group, don't we need a social identity to know that there is unfairness, injustice, and suppression of certain groups and certain identities? And if we don't see identity, and we can't fix it. But it looks to me, and my response was, if we don't give authority and belief to identity, that's the best way of undoing injustice against groups. Because we see human beings, we see persons, we see a whole universe in a human being. We don't see just, you're a black, you're a Palestinian, you're a Mizrahi, you're a Ashkenazi, you're a Israeli, you're a foreigner. And I gave the story of the workshops we did between Palestinians and Israelis, bringing Israelis to Shechem, to Nablus, a month after month, for years, hundreds and hundreds of Israelis and Palestinians, and in one weekend, we did amazing things. And the main thing that happened was the Dharma allowing us, Israelis and Palestinians, to see each other as human beings, and no longer as Israeli, and no longer as Palestinian, but to see a full human being looking straight in the eyes. And that is the end of conflict. From there, peace is made, can be in one day. So we have to be careful a little bit in being too Buddhist about anatta. There are huge bookcases full of books on the subject of shunyata or emptiness. And mostly avoid them. I know I got really bogged down in the Tibetan texts on emptiness. It's just like the Talmud is nothing compared to that stuff. We had some interesting dialogues on the self with scientists in Israel, and actually I've been a subject of some science. So I have a background in science. I have a doctorate in molecular biology from way back. Now I find myself to be the Shafan Nasir, a guinea pig in experiments on me. But actually we wrote two big scientific papers on experiences of emptiness or experiences of non-self, which were at the Bar-Ilan and the Weizmann, and basically on my experience. So measuring my brain, but also looking at dimensions of selfing and non-self. How is experienced? And I learned a lot myself to be a subject in these studies. Because there was a brilliant guy, Yochai, he's a total genius, and he ask me these beautiful, very, very careful questions while in states of meditation, asking me very, very careful questions of experiences of emptiness. Ownership, when you move your hand, boundaries, place, where is place? Where is sensation of body? Where is the hand? Where is ownership of the hand? Who is moving? Who is in control? Who is not in control? In different states of meditation, where is control? Who's in charge? Very delicate questions. Who's how much in charge? Give it 1 to 10. But why I'm saying this is that I'm inviting all of you to do something similar. When you're breathing, who's in charge? When you go to the toilet and you shit in the toilet, is it you that you're losing? If so, take it back. When your back is hurting, who is in control? Is your back in control of you? Are you in control of your back? Well, if you're in your control of your back, you could stop it straight away, but you cannot. So your back is controlling you, or is it? Who's in charge? Who's in charge of the breath? Who's in charge of... When you're hungry, you go to eat. Who's telling you this? Who's in charge of... Your stomach is in charge. Who owns what? Where is ownership? Where is you? In your finger? This is me here? These are questions, we can play with it, but it tells us that conditions arise by themselves. We have a tendency to automatically create a self from conditions that arise, to create an experience of selfing. And it's painful. Experience of selfing is painful because it's hiding the truth of freedom. It's like this, we look at life like this. The self, like the story of the king in the castle, the king is the self. And he's in a castle made of walls. He's thinking he's got huge power. He's a king. I'm in charge. I can do anything. But actually he's in prison and he doesn't know it. This is the self. We're like this inner self and we don't know what it's like to open, to drop anatta, to drop this illusion of me as the center of everything. There's a Zen phrase from this crazy 70s, I think. It was actually an American hippie, but he called himself Wei Wu Wei. And he said, why are you unhappy? Because 99% of everything you think or you say or everything you do is for yourself and there isn't one. The three characteristics as Dharma that are in the center of our experience, they are connected with each other. They're not three independent. They're three independent elements. For example, dukkha. When we realize that dukkha is not personal, that the pain we feel, we may feel it really personally, like woundedness. We are hurt, and we take it personally. But if we step back and have a hint of anatta, we understand that it's just the conditions of life that shaped us like this. And we don't need to take dukkha personally. Anatta helps us to understand dukkha. Anatta and dukkha then work together to help our freedom. We don't need to take it personally. When we don't take dukkha personally, it's just passing through. It's just life that is talking through us, that is doing things to us. It's not us that we have to be, not only be a victim, but blame ourselves for our dukkha. So we can then relax and say, yes, there is dukkha, but I don't need to take it personally. And that's the source of compassion. If we understand that the dukkha isn't personal, it comes from the nature of things. We don't own dukkha, it appears to us. We didn't say, I want to sit and have a back pain right now. This is my mission for this retreat, is to have as much back pain as possible. It comes and it goes when it wants. It comes and it goes because of stories that we have no control. It comes and it goes because of the influence of the world. So we don't need to take dukkha personally. And this is a great relief to us. Difficult mind states, which we own, like being a victim. They're mind states. We own them. I am the victim. It happened to me. I'm struggling. I'm suffering. It doesn't stop. I wake up depressed every day. But do we need the I in there? And a little bit of understanding that it happens through me from the world will allow us to kind of open and say, yes, it's happening, it's not pleasant, but I don't need to add to it the sense of me. And compassion comes from that. And the Buddha, by the way, turned all this on its head, and I'm going to be talking about this later, and he says, there can't be a self. Because who wants a thing that causes us so much pain? Therefore, God didn't make mistakes. Therefore, there can't be a self. Because it just causes us pain. So there can't be a thing like that. But we made a mistake. So he turned this whole thing on its head as proof that there's no self. Because who would want to have an organ that does, that causes trouble? And we can see the interaction of self, of anatta, of atta and dukkha in many different ways. They interact. In our own experience, we can see the way the two come together. For example, the illusion of control. How the illusion, ashlaya, that we are in control, how it causes dukkha. So the self and the dukkha, and atta and dukkha are closely connected. The need to control, the need to fix, the need to stop things causes pain. Why is the need there? Because of me. So I'm going to more or less finish here. I can say that in this retreat I invite you all to explore all of the three, dukkha, anicca and anatta. Each one of them can be for us, we can get deeply into each one of them, that's fine. Different teachers in the Buddhist tradition emphasize different things, different paths emphasize one, would emphasize more dukkha as a liberating movement, anicca as a liberating movement, or anatta as a liberating movement. Any of them are good enough. They're all there as the liberating dharma inside our experience. I never forget, because it's so strong in my memory, the Goenka retreats. Goenka, coming from Burmese, tradition emphasizes anicca, And so I just, after 15 retreats, I think, with Goenka and with the Mother Sayama, Burmese teacher, that I sat, I just can't get out of my mind this voice of Goenka, Anicca. So it's any of the three and all of them together bring us wisdom, bring us Dharma, stop the wheel of samsara, the automatic building of constructions that we don't see and we don't know and make us live in illusion. And there are many, many ways to see each of them. There is not one way. It doesn't really matter how you go to them or where you, how you see them, but the seeing is the key. We need to see the self, for example, the way we make a self, in order to free ourselves from it. So it's not a problem to feel a subject, to feel selfing. It's not a problem. It's a help. That we feel ownership. But we need to start from that. Yes, I feel my back is hurting. Now let me look and what is the my in my back? So it's fine to start with meeting the self as an experience and then going through it. And it's like everything we do in a retreat is meeting an experience and going inside it and going through it and looking more deeply and looking at it with a microscope. I like, and I'm going to, again, we talk about this more later in the retreat, but I really like what talks to me in the Bible, the Tanakh, is a few times Elohim has asked a human being, "Where are you?" A few times it happened. It happened with Abraham. It happened with Moshe. It happened with Adam. God asked Adam, "Ayeka, where are you?" And Adam answered by covering himself up. He answered, "I'm a human being and I'm in shame." Big problem. But Abraham is a great soul and he simply answered, "Hineni." And Hineni is a beautiful answer. God, meaning ultimacy, Hamuchlat, the infinite, is asking you, "Where are you?" And you say, "Hineni." This is the beginning of wisdom. Hineni. To finish with a quote from Dogen, spiritual life is to meet the self. To meet the self. To meet the self is to lose the self. And to lose the self is to be enlightened by all things. Thank you. Let's have a minute of quiet.